1 Corinthians 1:18 through 1:25. The fourth talk in a series on 1 Corinthians was presented by Ron Julian on March 24, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We are continuing in 1 Corinthians this morning. I've been saying that in order to understand what Paul's doing in the first several chapters of Corinthians, that we need to not get distracted by the fact that he starts out talking about the divisions among them. He starts out with what I'm calling his smaller point, which is the idea that the divisions among them reflect a bad understanding of discipleship, that they are not Paul's disciple or Apollos' disciple, but they all together are disciples of Christ. I call that his smaller point, not because that is not an important point. It's a very important point, and we've talked about that before. But he has an even bigger point that he wants to talk about with them, and that is the foolishness, the worldliness, the lack of perspective that has led a number of those in Corinth to look down on Paul. Paul, the apostle to the Gentiles, is being rejected by a number of people in Corinth because they don't think that he speaks with wisdom. And it's that topic that we want to turn to today. We're going to talk a lot this morning about their concept of wisdom and what Paul has to say about that. I just comment as we get started, it's interesting to note and to think about the fine line that Paul has to walk in the Corinthian letters. You can see it in 1 Corinthians. You can really see it in 2 Corinthians, where the issues start to get even more pointed, that Paul wants to be talking about himself and, in essence, defending his ministry. And yet, at the same time, he doesn't want to make it about him. He wants to defend himself and not defend himself at the same time. It's basically, I'm not saying that I am a big deal personally, but I am, after all, chosen by Christ to be an appointed representative of his message. So, you know, you can think what you want about me, but to dismiss me is to dismiss the message of Christ, and that we can't make light of that. I can't pretend that that's okay with me, because it's not. That's not an okay thing. So that's the line that Paul is going to be walking as we go through this. He's defending his gospel, not himself. Okay, let me start reading. I guess we're around verse 17 here. I didn't write it down. In chapter 1. I'll pick up at the end of what we were looking at last time. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not in wisdom of word, in order that the cross of Christ might not be nullified. For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since, in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through its wisdom, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For Jews ask for signs, and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, and to Gentiles foolishness. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. So, Paul, as I said last time, is turning in this verse, although it may not be immediately apparent. He was talking about baptism. Why was he talking about baptism? Because he was making the point, I'm glad I didn't baptize that many of you, because I don't want anybody to think that you're my disciple. And that's what I've called his minor point in this section. Don't mistake me for your master. I'm not. But he uses this language to turn and face what is basically his major point. What did Christ send me to do? He didn't send me to baptize. He sent me to preach the gospel. Okay. And so now we're on the topic of what did Christ send me to do? Let's talk about what Christ sent me to do. Because what he sent me to do is not what you guys seem to think that he ought to have sent me to do. He did not send me to preach the gospel in wisdom of word. And again, I want to emphasize that we need to understand that this is not coming from nowhere. Paul doesn't start talking about wisdom here because he just thought it would be interesting. He said, gee, I know I'm writing the Bible and we need to have something in the Bible about wisdom, so I guess I better put this in here. That's not the way it works. He's writing to the Corinthians who, it becomes more and more apparent as you go along, have a problem with the way Paul speaks, and they don't think that he uses wisdom in the way that he does it. So when he says that Christ didn't send me to preach in wisdom of word, that's their language. He's responding to the issue that they have raised, that Paul is not a wise man in some sense that they would mean. Now, some of your translations may have something like cleverness or something like that rather than wisdom here, and I can understand why they would do that, because it's sort of shocking to have Paul say, Christ didn't send me to preach with wisdom. What? That sounds terrible. I mean, he sent you to preach folly and foolishness? What are you talking about, Paul? We need to understand, though, the term here has been given him by the Corinthians. He's not denying the wisdom of the gospel. In fact, he's going to assert it. It is wise. But it is not wise with the kind of, quote, wisdom that the Corinthians are looking for. So we need to kind of see this expression with quotes. He didn't send me to preach with wisdom of word. He did not send me to use speech that is wise in the way that you guys think it ought to be wise. But wisdom is the issue. If your translation says cleverness at this spot, the word he uses is the basic meat and potatoes word for wisdom, because that's the issue through this whole section. The word wisdom and wise is going to show up over and over again. That's what he has on his mind. Why is it that he doesn't use this wisdom that they think that he ought to? He says, in order that the cross of Christ might not be nullified. Now, what he's going to go on to say, I think, is an explanation of what he means by this. But let me sort of step back and give you what I think is the basic idea. The Corinthians want Paul to be using powerful and effective speech. They want him to be impressive. They want him to be a winner. They want him to be the kind of guy that everybody listens to, and everybody in town, all of the important, influential people are listening to him and going, well, it's just hard to get around that, isn't it? But that's a guy that you got to take into account and pay attention to. That's a persuasive man. Oh, yeah, boy, we've got to deal with him. Why isn't more of this happening? Well, because Paul is easy to dismiss as foolish. Oh, that stuff he talks about, that doesn't really amount to much. They want a preacher who's going to command the respect of the beautiful people, the people who count. The key words, I think, would be that they're looking for are dynamic, effective, attractive, persuasive, compelling, respected, highly thought of, successful. That's what they're looking for in Paul. Paul's point in this section is basically, there's a little problem with that, and that is that there is something highly offensive at the heart of the gospel. In order to make my message attractive in the way you Corinthians would like it to be attractive, I would have to remove the cross from it. Because the cross is at the heart of this message, and the cross, rightly understood, is the part that makes people dismiss it. My whole purpose in preaching is to confront people with this offensive message and let them decide what they're going to do about it. Yeah, I know I could be more attractive, more winsome, and be seen as wise and persuasive if I were to leave that part out. But then it wouldn't be the message that I have been sent to proclaim. You can't mix them up. You've got to decide, are you going to proclaim the offensive part of this message? And if you do, then you're going to lose people. Or are you going to make it attractive, more superficially attractive, and get more people attracted to it, but in the process end up losing what it is that you were calling them to in the first place? That's the issue that Paul has on his mind in this section, I think. He goes on to start explaining what he means when he talks about the cross of Christ being nullified. He says, "For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God." For the Corinthians, the issue is, come on, Paul, use the right bait here, and you're going to be a lot more persuasive and a lot more attractive, and things are really going to happen. But for Paul, the issue is not crafting the message in the right way. The issue is the audience. What's true of the person that's listening to this? It's not the issue of how I've presented it. The issue is what's going on with them. The world is divided into two groups, those who are perishing and those who are being saved. What is it that divides them? What makes the difference between these groups? Well, one way to describe it is, how do they look at this message about the cross? Paul can't take the message of the cross and dress it up enough to make it seem wise to those who are not buying that message, who see that it's foolish. All you can do is take it out, but that's not going to get you anywhere. Now, I want to talk in a minute about maybe why that might be. Paul's going to say some more about that in a minute. But basically, he's saying the world is divided into these two groups, and those who are perishing see the word of the cross as foolishness, and there's nothing I can do about that. There's no wisdom in the world that I can paint on this to make it work for them. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. This is from Isaiah, written to Israel at a time when they were in the midst of their disobedience and blindness and rebellion against God. And God, as I'm understanding it, is saying to them through Isaiah, you know, you guys think you're so smart. You've got it all figured out. We're going to make an alliance with this country over here. We don't really need to worry about God because we're going to make this work. We're going to solve our political problems. We're going to find security for our nation. We're going to make this thing work. But God's saying to them, you know what's going to happen? Things are going to come along that you have no idea about. I am going to do things in such a way that all your wisdom is going to be set aside. And in the end, everybody will be looking and saying what all the wise men thought was so wise is going to end up being shown to have been foolish. You put your trust in armies and negotiations, and you lost sight of the God of Israel. And that was an incredibly foolish thing to do, as circumstances are going to show. So, I think Paul is quoting this language, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside, and applying it to this same situation. If God did that in the historical circumstances of Israel before, he has really done it now. He has really done something that, when it comes to its fruition, is going to show how foolish those who think they are wise have been. And what we're talking about is the cross of Christ, the gospel. What God is doing in Christ is going to, in the end, show how foolish the wisdom of the world is. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? And as we're going to see, it is through the gospel, it is through what Christ did on the cross that he has done this thing. The names that Paul uses here are instructive to us, I think. He asks, where is the wise man? Which is speaking to this issue of wisdom that the Greeks, especially in Corinth, or those who have been influenced by Greek thinking, are looking for. This is the philosopher. This is the persuasive speaker, the man of wisdom, the one who speaks and everyone is blown away by how much he's nailed it and how nobody can answer his wise sayings. Then he says, where is the scribe? And I think he's referring here to the Jewish scribes, the Jewish concept of the wise man, who would be the philosopher in the Jewish culture. It's the rabbi, the one who has studied the scriptures and understands what the scriptures are all about and can give a judgment on, well, so how do we keep the law? Should we do this or should we do this? In the Jewish culture, that's the one who would be looked at as the wise one, the one who has the answers, the persuasive, compelling one. And then he says, where is the debater of this age? And I think the word debater is interesting because I understand the issue of the wisdom that they're talking about to be at least influenced by, as I mentioned before, the idea of the sophists, the wise, who were powerful debaters. And as we saw in Acts, Apollos is a powerful debater. And the divisions here in Corinth seem to be that many have chosen Apollos over Paul. Why? Well, I think when you put it all together, it's partly because he's a hot debater. He blows them away. He goes into the synagogue and proves that Jesus is the Christ from the scriptures. And everybody's impressed with, wow, that guy is hot. And that is impressive to many of the Corinthians. But where are all of these? The people of this age, the wise man, the scribe, the debater, who among them can stand up before God? Because God has made all of it foolish. The wisdom of the world, what the Greeks think is wise and what the Jews think is wise, all of that has been shown to be foolish by what God has done. How did he do this? Well, the supreme example of God showing the wise how foolish they are is what he has done in the gospel. For, since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through its wisdom, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. Okay, now, I've noticed sometimes people get tangled up in this verse a little bit. The words wisdom and foolishness are bouncing around in a way that may be hard to follow. First of all, what we're looking at here is this contrast between the wisdom of God and the wisdom of the world. In God's wisdom, which is really wisdom, he has put the world together in a certain way. God could have made the world so that the intellectual elite were the ones who found their way to God first. But God's wise decision was to show the emptiness at the heart of worldly wisdom by making it the road to nowhere. It can get you some places, but in the end it doesn't get you to God. There's a lot of wisdom in the world, of a sort. We human beings are very smart. And we have come to understand a lot of things. But the striking thing about us is, as much as we have explored and examined and thought about reality, there is this part of reality to which we are blind. No matter how we put the picture together, we always seem to end up missing God. And from God's perspective, that is the great indictment on the wisdom of the world. If you think about it, how smart can you be if you miss the ground of all being and the one who created everything and the one with whom I must do business? How wise can I be if I missed God in the process of my reasonings? It's the great scandal of the human race that with all our brilliance we have missed God. We should have found God. And I think Paul is, we should be clear about this in our own minds, that Paul believes that God is there, and that a healthy, functioning mind, if it follows reason and truth, will find its way to God. It's not actually that hard to find. But we don't. Because we are stubborn, and we don't want the truth about God to be the truth about God. That's why he says, God is well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. Now, this verse is misunderstood sometimes, and we need to be careful here. Paul is not saying that the gospel is foolish. He's not saying that it is irrational and you shouldn't try to think about it because it's just foolishness and you can't get anywhere with your rational mind. You need to just accept it in all of its foolishness. I hear people talking that way sometimes. That's not what Paul is getting at here. What he's saying is the world around us thinks that the gospel is foolish. But why should that bother God? The world is so smart, but it missed God. How smart can it be? So God is quite happy to save people with a message that the world thinks is foolish. Paul is addressing this tension. You guys want me to speak in this way that is going to be seen as being wise and profound and persuasive. But I'm telling you that that kind of presentation, that kind of thinking, look at where it got the world. They missed God altogether. God is quite content to save people through a message that most of the world finds to be foolish. He doesn't have to dress it up and make it something that everybody will look at and say, wow, how impressive that is. He says, you wise who think you're so wise and don't even know me, I don't care whether you think my gospel is wise or not. The fact is, it is wise. It's the truth. It's profound. The fact that you don't think so doesn't bother me. I'm quite content to save those who believe through a message that the rest of the world thinks is foolish. God doesn't get converts by changing the message to make it seem wise. He gets converts by changing people so that they can see the wisdom of the message itself. Okay, so Paul, seems to me, has a great deal of experience with this process. I mean, at this point, who in the world has had more experience with taking the message of the gospel to Greeks and to Jews and seeing how they react, looking at the process that they go through? And he talks a little bit about that. He says, "For Jews ask for signs, and Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, and to Gentiles foolishness. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God." Okay, so I think we should probably stop for a second and think a little bit about this message that Paul preaches and why it gets the kind of reaction that he's talking about. Because Paul doesn't go into much detail here about what it is about this message. What is it that he's saying and what it is that people are objecting to? He just refers to it as the word of the cross, and here he refers to his message as Christ crucified. That's my message. First of all, it's a message about Christ. The word Christ is the Greek word that means anointed one. It's the Greek word that corresponds to the Hebrew word Mashiach, Messiah, which means anointed one. This word is rooted in the promises of the Old Testament that God is going to establish the throne of David, that a king of Israel is going to rule forever over all creation. He is going to establish justice and righteousness, and God's rule is going to be extended over all. All of the enemies of God, all of the enemies of Israel are going to ultimately be put down, destroyed, and the world is going to be a place where God's people can live in peace and with sin and death removed. This message was proclaimed in the Old Testament. part of Paul's message is Jesus of Nazareth is the Christ. He is the Messiah. That's part of the apostolic message. That's clear when you go through, you read Acts and you read Paul's letters, you read all the letters. One of the essential thrusts of his message was that guy Jesus, who was crucified on a cross, he is the Messiah, the Christ, the anointed one who is going to bring the world into freedom and justice and holiness and the rule of God. But the other part of his message is Christ crucified. It's that guy Jesus who was nailed to a cross as a common criminal and died. That's the guy who is the Messiah. That's the part that's hard to deal with. What kind of a savior comes and dies? I mean, you charge into a war scene, I've come to rescue you, and somebody picks you off and you're lying there dead. Great. That was helpful. Anybody else want to try saving us? Somebody who managed to stay alive a little bit? What kind of a savior do we need? What's the real problem? We don't just need a political savior. We don't just need freedom from oppression and hunger and injustice, although we need deliverance from those things. The root problem is the problem of our evil and our guilt before God. We have lost any right to expect that God is going to deal with us favorably. We are rebels against God, each and every one of us. We have this problem. We do not do right. And even when we know what we ought to do, we still don't do right. That's us. When we look at the cross, we see God's solution to the problem. We see God's judgment on sin, but we see God's mercy towards sinners. This is a huge deal. This is God saying, I know what your problem is, and here's my remedy. Because Christ has brought us God's mercy, we have the hope that one day we will be freed from all traces of evil, from death, from everything that makes life difficult now. Now, Paul has had a lot of experience preaching this message, and he knows the kind of reaction that he gets. First of all, from the Jews, he knows on the one hand that they have an advantage. They know what he's talking about. They know who the Messiah is in general terms. I don't mean that they know that Jesus is the Messiah, but they know the Old Testament. They know the promises of God. They know the promise of deliverance and the kingdom of God and the reign of God's anointed one over all the earth. They're waiting for it. They're looking for it. We can see at the time of Jesus, John the Baptist shows up and people are asking him, are you the Messiah? That's what we're looking for. Paul describes them, though, as seeking for signs. Seeking for signs is not a bad thing in and of itself. Signs are not a bad thing. God sent signs with the ministry of Jesus and with the ministry of his apostles. Miraculous signs that said, yes, I am behind this message. So it's not wrong to ask the question, are you really from God? And what sign is there that would tell me that that's true? It's rational to ask that kind of question, it seems to me. But the problem is that the message that accompanied these signs was not the message that the Jews were looking for. I mean, it's hard not to think of Jesus, you know, he would do some incredibly miraculous thing, healing somebody, raising the dead, all this stuff, and the Jews would say, well, what sign do you do? I mean, it became clear that it wasn't ultimately going to be the issue of the sign. The sign had to accompany somebody that makes sense to us, somebody that we're looking for. This guy walking down the street in his humble clothes and probably dirty and unimpressive and so on, you're going to tell me this is the deliverer from God who's going to kick out the Romans and bring justice to the entire world? No. We're looking for the power. The sign is going to show us the power of God. There's God at work. That's what we're looking for. This guy Jesus ultimately ended up being hung on a cross and dying. I mean, what more evidence do you need that he was under the curse of God, that he ended up hanging there on a cross, a common criminal? We don't need to listen to a message about him. Paul also had experience preaching to Gentiles. He says the Greeks are looking for wisdom. And this is very relevant to the issue here because the Greeks in Corinth are in fact looking for wisdom from Paul. They're attracted to the guy who can say the impressive thing and win the argument and win the crowd to his side through the force of his skill in debate and speech and his powerful ideas. But Paul's gospel of a crucified Christ is not surefire material. It's not the sort of thing that you go out and preach it and everybody says, wow, that's impressive. He knows that that's the case. We saw it in Acts before he went to Corinth, where he goes to Athens, and he's making some interesting points, and people are following along with him, and until he starts to talk about the judgment of God and God having raised Jesus from the dead, and now they go, oh, okay, now we see what's going on. This is foolishness. We know that that is not an intellectually respectable position to be taken. We've already decided that that doesn't work. Resurrection? No. That's not the way it works. Paul realizes that in and of itself, the message of the gospel is going to be a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Greeks. Jesus is not the kind of Messiah that the Jews were looking for, and the gospel is not the kind of philosophy that the Greeks were looking for. Who is it that ends up believing then? It is the called, those whom God has called to salvation. What is different about them? Well, they're still Jews. They're still Gentiles. They're still products of the culture that brought about the people that are all around them. But they have eyes to see and ears to hear, to use the language of Jesus. They understand. Are you looking for the power of God at work? Look at the cross. There God has reached out a mighty arm to save us from our own guilt, to save us from eternal destruction. How much more power do you need to see than the power to reach out and forgive someone like me and rescue me from death and bring me to life? That's power. Are you looking for the wisdom of God? Look at the message of the cross. On the cross, we see the expression of the Creator himself. We see what he thinks about sin, but we also see his mercy and intent to forgive and restore. We see the kind of salvation we really need in the cross. The person who has understood the cross, because it is not a simple message, it is profound in its implications. The person who has understood the cross has understood some of the deepest and most important truths that there are. But the problem is, you have to be able to get past that blindness that people have when it comes to anything regarding their obligation to God, the reality of their own evil, and all of that sort of thing. That's anathema. We don't want to think about that. Paul says here an interesting thing, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. This is another one of those lines that I think gets distorted. Paul is obviously using an interesting turn of phrase here, but he is not saying that the gospel is actually foolish or weak. What he's saying is that man in his wisdom, the wise men of our age, look at the gospel and see it to be foolish and weak. That's not power. That's not wisdom. Paul's point is, when it comes to God, what men dismiss as foolishness is in fact wiser than their wisdom. And what men dismiss as weak is in fact more powerful than all of their power put together. Okay. In essence, what Paul has done here is he has spoken to the issue of, why do I speak the way I do? Why don't I use the kind of surefire material that would be winning me more converts and make me more impressive and make me seem wise and make it so that you're not embarrassed to hang around with me? Why don't I do that? Well, because it is incompatible with the message that I preach. There comes a point at which, in order to win the crowd the way you want me to do it, I would have to take the gospel and turn it into something else. And I'm not interested in doing that. And God is not interested in doing that. God has no interest in taking the gospel and making it attractive in the world's eyes. That's not how he's going to get people on his team, by pandering to them, by catering to their foolishness. That's not how it's going to happen. So Paul is taking a pretty hard line with them here in a way. He's saying, yeah, I know what you'd like me to be doing, but you know what? No, I'm not going to. Not interested. And if you think I'm foolish and unimpressive because of it, well, you're just going to have to think that. But you'd better not, because you're dismissing the wisdom of God for the wisdom of the world. Okay, so I think I'll draw a line on talking any more about any of the passage from here, but I want to make some comments. First of all, it seems to me that it's very interesting to look at the situation that Paul is in and the kind of seduction that he is resisting. There is this seduction to the approval of the crowd, the approval of the world around me. I know that there are things I can do and things I can say that will make me more palatable to people in various ways. And I like that. I like having that sort of approval. Here's Paul. The church that he founded wants him to stop embarrassing them. You can imagine how there would be a certain sense of, I would like to please people. I would like to make them happy. I would like them to think well of me. A significant number of people in this church do not think well of me, and I want them to. If I were in Paul's situation, I can tell you, I would be feeling that. I personally believe very strongly in that we should not fear men, but my individual journey in life has been one of struggling with that issue. I don't like it when people don't like me. And I am very tempted to want to find some way to make everybody happy with me. Now, sometimes they're not happy with me because I'm a jerk, and then I should stop being a jerk. And whether they're happy with me or not, I should stop being a jerk, and that's true. But there comes that point where that's not it. I just know that if I were to do certain things, I could make people happy. But the thing is, I don't think I ought to do them. This pressure is all around us. If you have any involvement in the academic world, you know that to be a success in the academic world, you have to speak wisdom. And there is an understood set of parameters for what wisdom looks like in the academic world. There are certain things you can say. We have the freedom, academic freedom, to say all sorts of things, except any number of things that you cannot say, because they are foolish. You can say just about any perverse thing you want. You can say things that are obviously not true if you just stop and think about them for 2 seconds, and you can be lauded as brilliant and revolutionary. But if you start talking about the cross of Christ as if it actually had some meaning in the world, you obviously are a fool, and we have no reason to listen to you. Do you want to be a political success? You can be a political success and talk about religion. You can even be a political success and talk about Jesus. But I think you would find it very difficult to be a political success and talk about the cross, because that's where the essence of the message comes in. That's where the offense of the message comes in. Can an American politician getting up and saying the American people are sinful people who deserve to be judged by God? We're Americans. That's unpatriotic. Well, I just think it's interesting to think about the choice that Paul made and the choice that we face. He believes that there is no middle ground between the cross and the world. If we embrace the message of the cross, then we are going to be seen as foolish by someone. And the question is whether we're willing to do that. He kept his message clean. He gave it straight, and he accepted the fallout. Now let me address another issue here. What is it, in what Paul has said here, what is he saying about the way we should proclaim the gospel? What are the implications of what he's saying here for how we should be talking? And I wanted to clarify a few things. First of all, is he saying that there's something wrong with speaking eloquently? Is he saying that you should be suspicious of anyone who uses eloquence and verbal beauty or something like that in their speech when they're talking about the gospel? They're trying to pull a fast one on you? No, I don't think so. Paul himself, I would argue, is quite eloquent. In this very section, where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? That's rhetoric. I mean, that's Paul using a certain style in his language. I mean, he's not going out of his way to be flowery or anything, but I would, to my mind, this is eloquent speech that he's using. What he's saying here, I mean, some of the stuff that Paul wrote, we pull out and put in greeting cards. I mean, and we put flowers all around it and everything. So, I mean, he can't have been so terrible at putting language together. But that's to miss the point here, I think. The issue is not eloquence. The issue is success. The Corinthians found Paul's message to be without power and wisdom because too many people found his message to be foolish. If people aren't buying it, then we must be doing something wrong, I think is the thinking back behind it. It's probably even more complicated than that, but I think that is, given how Paul responds to them, that is a central part of the issue for him. I can't help thinking of, I don't know if he would say this sort of thing anymore, but back when I was getting started as a Christian, I remember being involved with people in Campus Crusade. And at that time, Bill Bright was basically saying, look, we have this great product in the gospel. Eternal life, how could anyone turn that down? So all we've got to do is package it right. The fact that the gospel is not making more inroads in the world is our fault because we're not packaging it right. And if we would package it right, then everyone will believe. That's the kind of language he was using back then. I don't know if he would still use that now. But from my perspective, that has very much missed the point. What Paul's saying here is the gospel is offensive. Ultimately, it takes a miracle for somebody to buy a message like this. Not because it is intellectually indefensible, but because it is offensive to me in my desire to be autonomous from God and to defend myself as the center of the universe. So the lesson here is not don't be eloquent. I think eloquence in its place can be fine. I wish I had more of it. Okay, now, is Paul saying in all of this about wisdom and foolishness and so on, is he saying or implying that there's something wrong with using reason to persuade people of the gospel? Again, I would say no. Paul believes that the gospel is true and defensible, and we see him defending it and using reason to defend it all the time. It's interesting what the book of Acts says that Paul did when he was in Corinth. And he was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath and trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. It's not that Paul was not trying to persuade people that it was true. He was trying to persuade them that it was true. Reason supports the truth. And we ourselves as believers need to be reasonable people. We need to listen to reason. If somebody has an argument against what we believe and it has a fair shot of being reasonable, then we need to listen to it and think about it and give an answer. What would I say to what they've just said? Paul isn't arguing against reason, but what he's saying is, in the end, the people of the world are not going to be reasonable. I should be reasonable in my discussions of the gospel, but it shouldn't surprise me if reason doesn't carry the day. We can't judge our message by how effective it is, because there is a moral roadblock in every human being. Okay, and then finally, I'll just make a little plug for the gospel here. We're coming up on Good Friday and Easter, and Paul is making it very clear here, at the heart of the gospel, the reason that we gather together here is the message of the cross. God is like a doctor who has examined us and said, I know just the medicine you need. And the medicine that we needed was for God to become a man and die on a cross and be raised again. As strange as it sounds, that's the medicine we needed. And I think we would do well to stop and remind ourselves that in the end, at the heart of this message, it's not a message that is about prosperity, although prosperity is, in the end, a result of it. It's not a message just about ethics and being good, although goodness has a great deal to do with this message. But at the heart of the message is the problem of our guilt and the loss that that is going to bring upon us. God has shown us what he thinks we need. We need mercy. We need to be rescued from our sin so that we won't be this way anymore. And that's what God has provided in the cross. That's why it's central to what we're doing. That's why any sort of message that takes the cross out of Christianity is not Christianity anymore. At least it's not the biblical gospel. I just read in the paper last week sometime, there was an article about, maybe some of you saw it, an article about a trend in some theological circles away from the emphasis on the cross in the gospel. There are groups that argue that a message about God dying for sins, as if punishment was needed for sins, is an archaic message, and it's one that turns people into warmongers and violent, and we need a peace message. We need to take this violent, bloody image out of the center of the Christian gospel and put in its place a picture of peace and justice. Nothing peaceful about a guy bleeding on a cross. Well, yeah, that's right. There isn't. Because there's a war going on, and the war has been between God and us. We've been fighting God. And that bloody image on the cross is the image of God reaching out to us and forgiving us for the war and ending the war and bringing us into peace. But nothing less was going to do it. God just couldn't say, oh, it's all right, because it's not all right. I just think it's important for us to notice Paul hasn't gone into the details of why in this section, but what he's saying is, at the heart of the message, the thing that's offensive to the world and yet is the power of God to us, is this message about Christ dying. And not just dying, but being raised again. Okay, so we've got a few minutes for any questions or comments you might have. We'll start with Terry.
The Corinthians seem to be enamored earlier, it seems, that with Apollos. Is the implication, therefore, that he is not preaching the cross?
That's a very good question. And I can't be dogmatic about this, but when you put all the evidence together, here is one plausible way of understanding what has happened. Luke in Acts speaks fairly highly of Apollos, that he actually was helpful to the Corinthians. And we know that Apollos is with Paul at the end of this letter, and that Paul is encouraging Apollos to go back. So I don't think that the picture is that Apollos has been an enemy of the cross or something like that. But think about his situation. He's a person who knows the Old Testament very well, and he is defending the idea that Jesus is the Christ by speaking to Old Testament passages. I can easily see the emphasis in that teaching being I mean, what is the Old Testament talking about? It's talking about the king, the one who is going to establish God's kingdom and establish peace and harmony and all of that sort of thing. I could easily see Apollos' message as centering on Jesus is the Christ, which is true, and that's essential. And so he hasn't done wrong to emphasize that, but what he has not emphasized is Christ crucified, what Paul is saying here. The idea that, in essence, it's that part of the gospel that has become clear through the ministry of Jesus and what he has taught his apostles, that at the center of God's purpose is this redemptive act that is going to rescue us from what our real problem is. So, not that Apollos would disagree with that necessarily, but I could see his emphasis being, his strength being in making that case that Jesus is the King of the world. And Jesus is the King of the world is a message that we know attracted a number of people. When you look at the problem with the Judaizers, I would say it was the same situation. I don't mean the same issue necessarily, but there you had a number of Jewish Pharisees who believed the message that Jesus was the Messiah. But they hadn't bought, really, the implication of the cross. They were still basically legalistic and self-justifying, self-righteous, because they understood, yes, Jesus is the Messiah, and God is going to save me because I'm a good Jew. You know, and they had put those two things together. Well, they had gotten the Christ part, but not the Christ crucified part, I think. They hadn't really seen the implications of the cross and what that was about. I don't know whether Apollos saw the implications of that or not. I think in the end he probably did. But my suspicion is that he didn't understand it well enough to really have that be a focus in his message. And so he was not saying the sorts of things that people would tend to find foolish. That is, they were impressed by the power of his argumentation, and he never was saying those things that Paul kept saying that seemed so ordinary and unimpressive. That's how I would put it together. Something like that.
Could you repeat how you understand the phrase that the cross of Christ might not be nullified? Is it that he's afraid the cross of Christ as a message will get lost, or what?
Yes, I think it's something like that. That the message of the cross, what Paul is saying is, the message of the cross has a power of its own. That power is, it offends those who are perishing, and it draws those who are being saved. The cross is the center of this message, and I don't want to speak with the kind of wisdom that you're talking about, because in order to do so, in essence, it would nullify the cross. Yeah, I would get more people to be attracted to it, but that powerful center of the message would have to, in essence, be nullified. It would have to be played down in such a way. I can't speak the message of the cross and have that wisdom that you want me to have at the same time. So if I have the wisdom, that's going to have to imply that I am somehow suppressing, somehow making nothing of the cross, because that's the only way I'm going to get more people than I'm getting now with the message, the way you guys are talking. And then I think he goes on to explain that in what he talks about, how many would see the cross as foolish and so on, but it is the power of God to those who are being saved. So I'm quite happy, just as God is happy, to save people with a message that the world thinks is foolish, because the alternative is to be seen wise and to basically squash the part that is the important part. Is that clear?
So the problem with that is, if you're going to expend energy to tell people about something, you should tell them about the important stuff. The less important stuff they might find more interesting, but it is less important, and then they haven't heard the more important stuff.
I'm not saying there's plenty of room for talking about unimportant things in life. And I don't think Paul is saying, I don't talk about unimportant things. I think what he's saying, though, is in order to be seen by the world around me as wise in the way you're talking about, I would have to take the gospel and distort it and turn it into something it is not. See, the idea would be I would still be saying it's the gospel. What you want me to do is to come as the representative of Christ and say, here is the gospel, but proclaim it in this way that it has power and it really gets people. Well, what Paul is saying is, if I were to do that, the gospel that I'm proclaiming would not be the gospel anymore. Sure, if you want to talk about botany or something like that with me, I'll do it. Sure. It's interesting. I mean, not to me. You understand. I have every aspect of biology out there I am colorblind to. This is a great bone that's missing in my head. Anything squishy or anything like that, I don't have anything to do with it. But Paul, being a well-rounded guy, probably would have said, sure, let's go out in the garden and get our hands dirty and talk about seeds or something. I mean, why not? But if you want me to be a representative of the gospel, I've only got one gospel to give. And I can't give it in such a way that I can be the representative of the gospel and be seen as the wise person that you want me to be seen as. I can't do both of those things. That's what I'm getting at. Anything else? We might have time for one more. Jack? You all don't realize what it's like to teach up here and have Jack raise his hand. He has a point. So this is where he's going to point out where I screwed up. So,
no,
and
just,
I do it to him too, so that's fine. But
no, you've already said this, but it's very helpful to me to make a distinction here between if I'm looking at this passage and asking myself the question, what should I do? I'm probably going to get it wrong. I'm probably going to be distorting what Paul is saying. I think what you've been suggesting is that it's a question of what do we want. That what he's addressing, the fallacy here is that the Corinthians want the wrong thing. Not that Apollos is doing the wrong thing or not that anybody else is doing the wrong thing, but what the Corinthians are responding to is out of a desire for the wrong thing.
Right.
That what they want is recognition, prestige, respect, what you call success in the world. And what Paul is saying is that's a losing battle. If you pursue truth, you will be a loser in the eyes of the world. Just get over it. I mean, just accept that and come to terms with that.
Yeah, that's good. That is what I'm saying. And I think there is room for the question. I think if Apollos had been more experienced and more mature, he probably could have done things to see that he was sort of helping to foster those desires and to do something to cut it short. I mean, in other words, he could have done something where his group would have abandoned him too, because they would say, oh no, in the end, he's not giving us what we want either. Somehow they thought he was, and perhaps he wasn't wise enough to see that he was contributing to that. But you're right. The issue, that's what I'm saying. It has to do with the people that the message is going to. In the end, what are you about? What are you looking for? And that's why this is so important and so significant, what Paul is saying to the Corinthians, because he's challenging them to confront the question of what are you about? Why are you so interested in this kind of worldly success? What sort of values are driving you here? Because in the end, the gospel's going one way and the world is going another way, and you're going to have to decide which team you want to be on. So yeah, that's good. Okay, I think I'll stop there. Everybody who's leaving for the basketball game can do so, if you haven't already.